Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, my very special guest is Brad Stilberg. Brad's work explores the principles of mastery that transcends capabilities and domains. Brad has learned that whether someone is trying to qualify for the Olympics, break ground in mathematical theory, launch a new business, or craft an artistic masterpiece, many of the practices underlying sustainable success are the same, supported by scientific evidence and available to everyone. Brad regularly writes in Outside magazine. He's also the author of the books The Passion Paradox, a guide to going all in, finding success, and discovering the benefits of an unbalanced life, and Peak Performance, Elevate Your Game, Avoid Burnout, and Thrive with the New Science of Success. These books explore the science and practice of productive passion and world-class performance. His prior experiences include working for the international consulting firm McKinsey & Company and a short stint at the White House with the National Economic Council. Just before we get into this week's interview with Brad, I would like to invite you to join us to improve your health and performance. Perhaps you've not been sleeping well, or been having digestive problems, or seasonal allergies, or headaches, or maybe you're constantly injured or not recovering as well as you'd like. Your body composition isn't what it should be given how much effort you put in, or maybe you're not enjoying your sport like you used to. You've already been to the doctor, and they didn't seem that interested in doing a proper investigation, or maybe they fobbed you off with some nonsense about just getting older. Maybe you already know the health behaviors that you need to do, but you're having a hard time getting motivated or staying consistent. This is where my expert team comes in. Using evidence-informed coaching based in ancestral health principles together with advanced lab testing and highly targeted nutritional supplementation, we can help you with your health and performance mindset to finally figure out what to eat and when, to overcome nutritional deficiencies, chronic low-grade infections, and environmental exposures. Now, if you've already been to the front page of our website to book an appointment, but were put off by the $10,000 price tag for our program, then I hear you. Lots of people have been telling me that they want something lighter and less expensive to get started. That's why we put together a $179 package that consists of a blood chemistry calculator report together with a video that can help you decipher your results on your own. If you're not familiar with the blood chemistry calculator, it's a tool which uses machine learning to predict, from a pretty simple blood test, what is likely going on inside your body and what might be going wrong. If you're in the US, then you should have no trouble getting the blood test done. If you're in the UK or Australia, then we can probably help you too. Just send us an email to support@nourishbalancethrive.com. You can also book with us online. Submit your health history ahead of your appointment on Zoom, and we'll help you prepare to take the next steps, which might be a custom MBT package tailored to suit your needs, or it might be a referral, or maybe you just have a few questions, and we can get you headed in the right direction in one session. You'll find the links for everything in the show notes for this episode over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Thank you so much. We very much look forward to working with you. Now, over to the interview. Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining me here today in a rainy Oakland. What is up with that? It's May and we got rain in California. I think I'm going back to London.
Oh, no. Don't leave so fast.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me here today. The reason I'm here is because you have a very cool new book. And the reason I discovered your book was because our performance psychologist, Simon Marshall, recommended it to one of our clients. And I have had such an incredible journey and education by reading all of the books that Simon recommends to our clients. It's just been absolutely incredible. And I will resist the temptation to reel off the list of books. But The Passion Paradox was one of those books. And it really was a revelation to me. The self-help genre is really hard to navigate. And I'm so glad that I have Simon. But yeah, I thought we might start, you know, by talking about the book. In talking about your own personal journey, I understand at one point you made it all the way to the White House. Can you talk about how that happened? Where did it start? Who were you with? What happened?
I was not there as the president. God forbid, that would be terrifying. So when I first finished undergraduate school, I took a job at a large international consulting firm called McKinsey & Company, and I absolutely loved the work. It was such a neat opportunity for me, then age 22, to be working with really high-level thinkers and problem solvers and in boardrooms with these C-level people that are running enormous organizations and in some cases, governments. A lot of my work at McKinsey was focused on healthcare. And there was a particular partner that I really admired and that I had worked with that took a job with Barack Obama at the White House. And this was right around the time that the Accountable Care Act, so health reform, was being passed. And Bob got there. That was the name of the partner, Dr. Bob, I call him, and was just, I don't want to say totally overwhelmed, but it's a really hard gig. He was in charge of healthcare for the National Economic Council. And I remember him calling me and basically saying, hey, you want to come work with me at the White House? At that point in my life, I knew that I was going to go back to graduate school to continue my education. So there was a natural transition anyways. And it seemed like a really neat opportunity. So I said, yes, let's do it. And I spent a little under 4 months with the National Economic Council. And this would have been back in 2010.
And what was it like?
It was neat. Again, I feel like it was a lifetime ago, but there was definitely some of the starstruck nature, just seeing these individuals that you like would see on television and being there with them. It was also horribly inefficient. It was very interesting coming from McKinsey & Company, which is a very fast-paced work environment, into the government. And I would have thought that even at that highest level of government, you know, maybe things would move pretty quickly. But it's a very different kind of organization where there are clearly politics and consensus building. So things actually moved a lot more slowly there than they had when I was at McKinsey & Company.
And how did it end? Why did it end?
I guess it ended primarily because I was going back to graduate school. There was a defined period that I would be helping out at the National Economic Council at the White House before going back to school. Prior to that, I think that there was definitely, and I write about this in both my books, there was a buildup now looking back on it that led to burnout, more so at McKinsey & Company than at the White House, to be honest, but just the inability to turn it off, both physically and then also psychologically. And for a short period of time, that led to really outstanding performance. But as I started to, I guess, over time, the performance was still pretty good. I mean, good enough to get me that gig at the White House. But I started having some physical symptoms, some psychological symptoms that, again, I had no idea what was happening at the time. But looking back on it now, it was pretty clear that I was on a path towards burnout. And I was actually very fortunate that I was going back to graduate school to A, avert really getting deep in the hole. And then B, I studied public health with a particular interest on wellness. So I was able to learn about the path that I was walking down and do my best to course correct. And now I've kind of made a career helping other people course correct, writing about this topic and trying to pull out some of the nuance. I mean, burnout is such a kind of a hot topic and highly discussed word, but very few people, I think, are peeling back the onion to say, well, is this a syndrome of other conditions? Is it its own thing? Is it about working too much? Is it about working for the wrong reasons? Is it about none of those things at all? And that's the stuff that really interests me right now.
So you wouldn't have been able to write The Passion Paradox before any of this happened then?
Yeah, that's right. I know that you've talked about mindsets on your podcast before. So Carol Dweck would be proud of me. The growth mindset version of this is all of this was training to do the work that I'm doing today. And I do firmly believe that.
Can you define passion for us?
Well, the first thing that I'll say is that in The Passion Paradox and the kind of passion that I've studied and written about is not romantic passion. So it's passion that is for some sort of activity or pursuit. There's a lot of commonalities between activity-based passion and romantic passion, but I think that they're worth separating. So then in this activity pursuit-based passion, I like to define it as the relentless pursuit of an endeavor with generally productive consequences. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that the definition of addiction is the relentless pursuit of something despite negative consequences.
Right.
And that's a recurring theme throughout the book. It's one of the many paradoxes of passion, is that passion and addiction are really two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. And what's happening psychologically, what's happening neurochemically when you are pursuing a passion versus when you're pursuing an addiction are actually quite similar. The only real difference is society says that the ends of a passion are productive, whereas the ends of an addiction are destructive.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how you go about finding your passion. I did an interview once with the director of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, Ken Ford. I loved that interview. And at the end of that podcast, he talked about finding your passion. And he made this joke that you don't find it in your sock drawer, right? It's not like an object that you lost that you need to go find. And I think you do a really good job in the passion paradox. So can you talk about how one goes about finding the passion?
There's a common myth, and there's actually some research that shows just how common this myth is, that you find your passion and it's like lightning striking. It's in your sock drawer. Suddenly, oh, this is my calling. This is the thing that I was meant to do. There's some polling that indicates that over 75% of people in America believe that that is how passion will happen to them. Mm-hmm. It's called a fit mindset of passion. Mm-hmm. They feel like they'll just find this activity that is a perfect fit that feels great right away. What the research also shows is that that's not how passion actually comes to be. Individuals that have long-term sustainable passions, they do not report when they look back that they were passionate about that thing right away. Mm-hmm. What they were doing is that they were just following their interests. They were pursuing things that they were curious about. And over time, those things emerged into passion. Mm-hmm. This sounds like a trivial distinction, but it's not. Because if you have the expectation that you are going to magically find your passion, and you are expecting to just find this activity or this career or this hobby that feels immediately outstanding from the get-go, you're always going to be searching because mm-hmm. that thing probably doesn't exist. And if it does exist, the minute that the honeymoon period is over, at the first sign of challenge or distress, you'll just say, oh, this must not be my passion. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on from it. Mm-hmm. This is one of the areas where activity-based passion is very similar to romantic passion. Mm-hmm. Individuals that believe that there's a one and only soulmate for them are far more likely to stay single than individuals that believe that love is cultivated over time. Because with the soulmate mindset, same thing, especially today with all these online dating apps, if your expectation is something's going to feel immediately perfect right away, then you're going to constantly be searching for that immediately perfect thing, when in fact, both in romantic passion and in activity-based passion, very rarely does something feel perfect right away. Perfect emerges over time, and it comes from pursuing your interest, being curious, and giving things time and space to unfold.
I think the world of dating highlights your point perfectly. And I think I learned this lesson the hard way, actually, with OkCupid. You know, I go on all these dates and I'd meet these women typically for coffee at where we are here and actually in Oakland in coffee shops. And exactly at the beginning, you walk in, you're like, oh shit. Like, you know, and you're like tempted to like back out or climb out the toilet window or something like that, you know. And then after a while, you realize that it's just not going to happen like that. I really feel I felt like I learned it the hard way. And then it's only when you sort of give up. That's what I felt like for me. I just sort of gave up. It's having expectations. And then accidentally, I started nurturing a relationship. And that woman's now my wife, right?
Yeah, and that's how it goes. And certainly, that's my relationship with writing, which my wife would tell you is like my second marriage, is to my work as a writer. When I started writing, there was no part of me that said, oh, I'm going to write as a career. Or even that I love this. Mm-hmm. It was more just, like it's really neat to reflect on things on the page. What would it look like to have a blog? So then I had a blog that no one but me read, but it forced me to write regularly, at least in my own mind. I felt accountable to the blog. So I wrote in a blog and then I started pitching magazines. Far removed from my brain was I'm going to be a writer. It was just this interest that I was following. And it was probably a good 4 years before I regularly started getting paid to do the work I had been doing and before I would say that I was passionate about it, which is so different from the message that so many people hear in the self-help genre or at commencement speeches, which is you've got to find your passion. Mm. Well, it's like, for fuck's sake, like, excuse my French, you can edit that out if you need to, but or we no, can keep it in there because that's how I feel.
Yeah, no, we definitely swear on this podcast.
That's yeah, okay. Well, then I'll go back. So then for fuck's sake, it's like if you are expecting that you're just going to stumble into this thing that is perfect right off the bat, you're going to be in seeking mode. Mm-hmm. And that is so different than being a practitioner. Because a practitioner, you're actually doing the thing, you're cultivating it, you're developing it, you give it time and space. If things don't feel great right away, that's okay. Whereas if you're in seeking mode, as I said, the minute things don't feel great, it's on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And I think so many people get stuck in this perpetual cycle of trying to find their passion. Whereas if the mindset was, I need to develop my passion, they'd probably have a better chance of landing on it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you had some advice in the book, and it reminds me of a joke that one of my friends at university had. And it went something along the lines of three words that are going to affect, have a profound impact and increase your future happiness. And that is lower your expectations. And I think it might be a Simpsons joke. I'm sure someone listening to this will know which episode of The Simpsons that was in. It might be, it might not. But it's actually pretty good advice, right? So to lower your expectations from cha-ching, this is it, I found it, to, oh, this is kind of interesting, right?
Yep. And then give yourself permission to pursue your interest.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Talk to me about, you know, I really wanted you to talk about, you know, how this related. Okay, so we found our passion. Let's say you've dived into something and it's effortless. The work is effortless. You really feel like you found something special. Like, how does this eventually lead to burnout? Like, that's the question. Like, why would it?
This is the second paradox of passion. There are so many. So the first, or maybe it's the third, depends on what order we go in. So the first paradox of passion is this passion addiction, which I'm going to come back to. The second is that you don't actually find your passion, you cultivate it. The third is that passion is a gift. It can be great. It can feel effortless. It can get you into flow, that state of being totally in the zone. But passion can also be a curse. Mm-hmm. What tends to happen is this. Individuals start out cultivating a passion and they really love the activity. And they do the activity because they love it. They do it more and more often. Then they start to suddenly have good results. People recognize them for their good results. They get external validation. The human brain craves external validation. So what often happens without people ever realizing it is that they end up becoming more passionate about the external validation they get from the activity than the activity itself. They love retweets more than writing articles. They love being interviewed more than competing in the sport. They love the idea of being promoted into the C-suite more than they like the actual work. This is the distinction between what psychologists call obsessive passion and harmonious passion. Harmonious passion is when you love the activity for the process of doing the thing itself. Obsessive passion is when you fall more in love with all the external stuff than the actual activity. Harmonious passion is strongly associated with life satisfaction, peak performance, and well-being. Obsessive passion is strongly associated with depression, anxiety, burnout, and unethical behavior. Now, I've yet to meet someone that is squarely 100% harmonious passion, right? These things totally exist on a spectrum. It feels good to get external validation. It feels good to do good work. It feels good to share that work. The problem becomes when that is what's pulling the wagon, mm-hmm. not your love for the activity itself. Mm-hmm. So in my own life, and in the coaching clients I work with, and in the book as well, I come out not saying you need to be squarely harmonious passion, but that the majority of your passion should come from within. Mm-hmm. And even if that's 51% to 49%, that's still probably okay. I mean, better would be 60-40. But I think that, again, talk about high expectations. What I don't want is people to read the book or listen to this and think that, oh, I must be like a Zen monk where I'm only internally motivated and I don't care at all about any of the external stuff.
That's not realistic.
Not realistic. You're going to set yourself up for self-judgment and failure. But I think it's so important to start to realize and to be honest with yourself about when the external stuff is staking too great a claim in your brain and when that's pulling you more than you want it to be. Mm-hmm. That's a quick route to burnout. Because that external stuff, it's outside of your control, and it's like weather patterns. And if you're constantly at the whims of the direction that the wind is blowing, you're going to burn out. Oh, I was great at this meeting today, or my supervisor gave me a great performance review, or I didn't do well. Oh, this race went really well. Oh, the weather was bad, so I didn't race well. This story got a million link clicks. Oh, the story I thought was going to do great didn't do great. That is just frenetic energy that blows you around. And if that's what you become passionate about, people get really tired of being blown around in that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you can keep your passion, at least the majority of it, focused on the actual activity that you're doing, that you have full control over, you can feel much more rooted and you can stay fulfilled, happy, perform well over time, regardless of the changing weather patterns. Mm-hmm.
I find this a very convincing explanation of some of the otherwise very difficult to understand examples that we see in the world. So one of the people that you write about in the book is Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos is a great example. She is the epitome of obsessive passion. Now, presumably she didn't start out this way. I do not think that Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of school to say, I'm going to commit massive fraud. She wanted to change the world.
Yeah,
she had really good intentions. Yeah. She was a very, very smart girl. And Elizabeth Holmes went into this line of work at Theranos where they were going to have a very specialized pinprick blood test that was going to be able to give you results faster and much cheaper, yada, yada, yada. Elizabeth Holmes was super passionate. She was on the cover of multiple magazines. The Washington Post wrote an article that I reference in the book where she straight up says that her passion and obsession is one of her greatest, if not her greatest, asset. What happened was, is Elizabeth Holmes started getting all of this external validation and all of this recognition. Her passion shifted from the science and from launching this company to make the world a better place to being seen and being perceived as an icon, a mogul of technology. Mm. And that led her to ultimately unethical behavior. Because in her case, when you tie your identity and your passion so strongly to the external result of something, when the results start going poorly, in her case, the market speculation was ahead of the science, you do anything you need to close that gap. So mm-hmm. she lied. Another great example of this, not mentioned in the book, but that's come up in conversation since, is Lance Armstrong.
Mm.
So same thing, Lance Armstrong, super passionate about cycling, a phenomenal cyclist, got sucked into that external validation so much to the point that he was willing to cheat when he wasn't winning,
mm-hmm.
which is so different from someone that stays true to the actual activity itself. If mm-hmm. Elizabeth Holmes would have gotten her fulfillment not out of being Silicon Valley's mogul, but out of actually doing interesting science, my guess is Theranos would still be in business and probably doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
If Lance Armstrong would have been able to keep the majority of his drive based on how good of a cyclist he could be, not based on if he's beating everyone else, my guess is Lance Armstrong wouldn't have cheated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that these are really good examples to show you that no, and it's not like, I firmly don't think that Lance Armstrong or Elizabeth Holmes, I don't think they're bad people. I think that they got sucked into this trap and they're extreme examples, but this happens on smaller scales all the time.
Absolutely. Well, you're reminding me of a conversation that Simon had with David Bailey, and they were talking about doping in masters athletes, you know, the age grouper, where obviously there's really nothing at stake, right? You're not, you know, what do you win? Like a stupid medal, like maybe your money back that you pay to enter the race. There's really nothing on the line. And yet still masters athletes choose to dope in order to hopefully get better results. And I think this goes a long way to explain it.
Yeah, it is. And again, it's this need for external validation and for achievement to feel whole versus being okay with just like doing the activity itself. And what's interesting is it's one thing to intellectually understand this. It's another thing to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in the book, I really tried to be heavy on the actual practices. Because understanding this, it's good. It's a start to be able to realize, oh, hey, I'm being pulled by external validation. But it's often not enough to actually make sure that your passion stays harmonious. Of all the practices in the book, the one that I find the most helpful is what I call the 24 to 48 hour rule. And I just love this. And what that rule says is that in the activity that you're passionate about, anytime you have an enormous success or a terrible defeat, give yourself 24 to 48 hours to celebrate the success or grieve the defeat, but then get back to doing the actual work itself. The more time that you spend feeling like the man or the woman because you did great, or feeling really crappy because you did poorly on some external measure, the stronger those roots are going to sink into your brain and you're going to start caring more and more about that stuff. Whereas if you get back to doing the actual work, you remind yourself in a very visceral, embodied way that what you actually love is doing the work itself. Put my own skin in the game. A prime example for me is when I write a story that does really well. There's a temptation to sit there on Twitter and refresh and see how many people are sharing it and stay up on the conversation about the story. I recognize that temptation. I can't think my way out of it because it's a really strong pull. So I act my way out of that. And what for me that means is I say, great, for 24 hours, I'm just going to let myself get drunk on all this external validation. Mm. But then after 24 hours, I'm going to go to the coffee shop I always write at. I'm going to turn off my internet browser. I'm going to look at the blank page and I'm going to start writing again.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 minutes into that process, I could care less about what's happening out in the world because what I actually like doing is the writing. Mm-hmm. Same thing for after a really crappy loss. My first book, Peak Performance, there was a lot of hope at my publishing house that it was going to be a New York Times bestseller. Got my hopes up. It wasn't. It sucked. I let myself feel bad about it for a few hours. And then I said, well, like, I need to practice what I preach. Stop moping. Get back to doing the work. Mm-hmm. It's so simple, yet it can be really, really hard. Mm-hmm.
Why didn't it become a New York Times bestseller? I've heard that that's kind of a game that is quite hard to play. And talking about the weather and things that are outside of your control, that's probably one of them, right?
And this just goes to show, it's so funny because I'm a quote-unquote expert on this topic, but I'm not immune to it. So I knew that all along that those lists are extremely hard to land on and there are all kinds of variables in a black box that puts a book on that list. But I still cared about it because like you want to be on it. And the second time around, I caught myself caring much less about it. Mm. So it's also just an experience that maybe you have to live through. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to your actual question, I'm not sure how books get on there. It's copies sold, but it's copies sold in certain bookstores and people try to buy their way onto the list. It's funny. It just goes to show how human I am. It's a really shitty proxy for if it's a good book and I know it. Yet, because it's the New York Times, like, I still care.
Yeah.
And I don't judge myself for caring. I just recognize and realize when I'm starting to care too much. And then I force myself to shift away from that and get back to doing the actual work.
Uh-huh. I'm sure your friends and family ask you about that. So did that book get on the New York Times bestseller list then, Brad? Did it? Like, you're like, ah!
So close. Maybe not even close. Who knows?
What do you know about the biology that drives this behavior? I find that incredibly interesting. And I'm a huge fan of, what would you call it? Evolutionary psychology, maybe, and ancestral health. I love looking at biology through the lens of evolution. Why is it that humans would behave in this way?
So we are programmed to behave in this way. If you think about why our species is here today, it's because we behave in this way. So let me explain for a minute. Thousands of years ago, back on the Serengeti, when our species was evolving, if we had a big kill and we had food, we couldn't just be content with having that food because not the figurative weather, but the literal weather back then could change and it could be famine. So we had to evolve to keep on wanting to push, to keep on wanting more, more, more. If we didn't want more, 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 you get selected out because the next time that there's famine, you don't eat. Mm-hmm. So this neurochemical that is very, very strong in humans is called dopamine. And dopamine does not make you feel good about accomplishment. It makes you feel good about the chase. It makes you crave the chase. Mm-hmm. Again, way back then when we were evolving, if you crave the chase, you're going to keep working to find more food. If you find more food, you're going to have a better chance of surviving and pass on your DNA. So our species, we're pushers. Like we have this innate part of us in our neurochemistry that is wired to be passionate, to push for more, 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 not to be content. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, at least for me, and in the book, I go into great detail, I think there's some real power in knowing that and accepting that. Mm. And then saying, okay, if I struggle to be content, how can I make sure that I point this energy in productive directions? Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between harmonious passion versus obsessive passion. Mm-hmm. If that energy is all about the next external thing, the next paycheck, the next raise, the next promotion, whatever it is in the ego contest, then it's going to lead to suffering. Mm-hmm. Whereas if that energy is pointed at doing things in alignment with your purpose because you actually love the work itself, that'll lead to a pretty fulfilling life. What's fascinating is the root of the word passion is passio, which means suffering. So this is something that modern science is just now shedding light on, but our ancestors have known this for a long time, that passion is this, it's like fire, rocket fuel. Mm. And if it's pointed in the right direction, take you to the moon. If it's pointed in the wrong direction, take you to the core of the earth in a bad way.
I think you use this term in the book, hedonic adaptation. Yeah. And I've heard Simon use the phrase, the hedonic treadmill.
Yeah, never enough, never enough. Hedonic adaptation is just that. You very quickly adapt to your current state of happiness. So whatever you have might feel like enough for a day, but then you always want more. Mm-hmm. One Olympic medal. Nope, I need two.
Yeah.
I finally hit 1,000 followers on Twitter. Nope, I need 2,000.
Lost 10 pounds.
Yep, now I want 15.
Yeah. My
podcast has 200,000 downloads, feels great for a day. Now I want 300,000.
Exactly.
And again, I think that the self-judgment never helps. So I've never met someone that doesn't feel this way. I think that trying to totally repress it just makes it stronger. Mm. I think my advice in my practice is to recognize we're wired like this. Like, yep, there I am wanting more. Reflect on that and then behave in a way that's more alignment with my values so I don't get on that treadmill.
Uh-huh.
Again, you know, I love when modern science and ancient wisdom converges. But long before hedonic adaptation was a term thrown around by modern behavioral scientists, the Buddha literally called this exact same cycle suffering.
Suffering. And you're reminding me, I interviewed a clinical psychologist. Her name is Ashley Mason. And in that interview, she said, you know, it's a bit like Santa Claus. You can't unknow that Santa Claus is not real. And once you know, right? Like if you know that the hedonic treadmill is a thing, like, oh, there I am, I'm doing that thing again. You know, yep. You can't unknow that. And so, you know, the temptation for me right now is to ask you, well, what do I do about that? You know, how do I stay off the hedonic treadmill? But maybe just knowing is enough.
I think knowing is a good first step. I think this notion of getting back to the work is really helpful. And then another thing that I discuss a lot in the book is just paying attention. So if you pay attention really closely to how what you're doing makes you feel, you can kind of rig that feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
Let me use myself as an example so I'm not making listeners feel bad. I'll just make myself feel bad. So for me, the hedonic treadmill as a writer often occurs with looking for external validation on social media. Is a story being discussed? Is it being shared? Or is a book selling? All these kind of very concrete metrics of performance. And uploading my social media feeds, it's like candy. In the short term, it feels really good because I get that hit of dopamine. But if I pay attention to how I feel in the long term, after spending even just an hour kind of like refreshing this crap, I say crap because I feel gross. I feel disgusting. And if you pay attention to that, your mind-body system knows. And the next time you're tempted to do it, you've got this counterforce to the ego candy, that craving, oh, I want to see how it's doing, which is, ooh, like last time you got sucked in the rabbit hole and spent 2 hours refreshing your Twitter, you felt kind of hollow and empty at the end of the day. Maybe you should go eat some brown rice instead of the candy. So I think paying attention is super helpful. Again, it's a big theme in the book. It's something I work on with my own coaching clients. Is if you really pay deep attention to how certain behaviors make you feel, like the reward-based learning system, right? You do something, it makes you feel a certain way. If it makes you feel good, you do it again. If it makes you feel crappy, you stop. That's a strong system. I think a lot of people struggle because there are all these things in modern technology that make it hard to really pay attention to how something makes you feel. But if you can tap into that, it's a self-guided way of learning what makes you feel good and what doesn't. Not to say that I'm immune from it. Every once in a while, I still fall in the social media rabbit hole, but I feel gross after. I note that feeling, and then I'm less likely to have that behavior happen again.
You're reminding me of Ellen Langer's work. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Ellen Langer, but the essence of it is that noticing is good for your health.
Yes.
And it's really hard with social media. And for me, that exact same thing happens to me, but I find that I lack the motivation to do deep work in coding. Like I'll be searching for shallow work to do.
Yeah. I think, again, it's brown rice versus candy. And what I mean by that is it's easier to start eating candy, but after 2 hours, you probably wish that you were eating brown rice for the whole 2 hours, not candy. So I feel like deep work, in that example, it's kind of like brown rice. Like the first few bites aren't going to taste as good as candy. But once you're in the zone, you're going to feel really nourished, where you would never feel that way if all you're eating is candy.
Talk about living the balanced life.
Bullshit.
Next question.
When asking people and reporting for my book, what the word balance brings up for them, most people answer that it's equal things in equal proportion. So you wake up, you walk the dog, you take the kids to school, you make lunch, you go to work, you work the 9 to 5. Maybe you exercise for a half an hour, you come home, you have dinner, you watch a TV show, and then you repeat. Some people, and this is completely values neutral, for some people, that is a really good way to live life. Other people, they feel like they're kind of going through the motions, and balance turns into going through the motions. So I think that rather than strive to be balanced, it's actually to identify the things that you care about, that you're passionate about, and then give yourself permission to go all in on those things. It's okay to be terribly unbalanced. So long, and this is a big so long as you have enough self-awareness to evaluate the trade-offs and the sacrifices that you're making to go all in. there are times and seasons to go all in on things, and there are times and seasons to go all in on other things. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting, and this is something that I've spoken about with Rich Roll, who I know you know and also admire, is rather than think about balance every day, maybe think about balance over the course of a lifetime.
Right.
So there might be a season where you are all in on writing. And that might be 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. There might be a season where you are all in on parenting. Same thing. I don't know how long that is. There might be a season where you're actually all in on leisure. And you kind of go all in on maybe six things over the course of a life. And at any one point in time, you actually look terribly unbalanced. But when you zoom out, you're quite balanced. Mm-hmm. And instead of having this superficial engagement in different things, you really get to go deep. And I'm a big believer that the pathway to flow, the pathway to really like love, is to care about something and go deep on it. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not to say that you need to do that to the exclusion of everything else. I think you can totally go deep on relationships and go deep on a vocation, or deep on training for sport and deep on a vocation. I just think it's hard to try to have everything at once. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is, again, you set yourself up for frustration, going through the motions. You're kind of doing 10 different things, all subpar, when you could be doing 1 to 3 things really well. And doing 1 to 3 things really well tends to make people self-report feeling better.
And so what are you all in on? That's a phrase that I hear all the time from clients. Now, when I learn about something and I decide that I'm interested in it, I go all in.
Yeah.
But what are the things that you're all in on at the moment? I mean, I know we have a boy exactly the same age, yeah, 15 months, which is a weird coincidence. So obviously you're very passionate about writing, and yep, then obviously you're very passionate about being a father. Like, how do you balance the, balance, there's that word,
right,
again, right?
Right, and maybe it's like boundaries. And I'd say that those are the two things for me. It's my writing, and then parenting. Mm-hmm. And the way that I think about it is that when I'm focusing on writing and when I'm focusing on work, that is the sole focus. And when I'm with my son Theo, that is the sole focus. So there are some really tight boundaries there. For me, it tends to be when Theo comes home from daycare, I'm off. And we were talking earlier before we went online, I took internet and stuff off my phone. So I close my computer and then that's it. And I'm with my son for the rest of the night. So over the course of a day even, there's a period where I'm all in there and then I'm all in on work. What I'm not doing is during the day, sending my family pictures of Theo, going on Facebook and posting about him, thinking about him, worrying about him. During the day, I am focused on my work. Mm. But at night, I'm not like trying to sneak in a tweet while I'm playing with him. Nope. Like, I am just with Theo and my wife. And there's a reckoning that during this season of my life, I'm probably not as great of a friend as I could be to other friends. I'm probably not as great of a family member as I could be to extended members of my family. I do my best to carve out time where I can really focus on that, but it's hard to do everything at once. And again, this is like the self-help crap that I hate and that I'm trying to reverse in this book, is the culture makes you think that you should do everything at once and you should do great at everything at once, but you can't.
Uh-huh.
So my philosophy, and some may agree with me, is to have a reckoning about that and then try to prioritize and choose what matters most to you now, realize that it will change, regularly evaluate that stuff, and then do the things that matter most to you and don't apologize for it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sensing a theme here in the podcast. We've talked before about the idea of polarized training, right?
Yeah, periodization.
You're either going hard or you're not, but not the middle ground. And then James Hewitt talked with Tommy about the cognitive middle gear, right? You're, yep, either going hard or you're not, which is basically what you just said.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that I'm occupying the parenting middle gear.
Yeah. Well, you have two kids, so I'm not there yet. It is funny how parenting just changes the game. In my first book, Peak Performance, there's a whole lot on the importance of sleep. Mm. And I didn't know it until I had a kid, but I was kind of attached to both like the physical need of sleep, I think we all are, but also the idea of sleep. Mm. And Theo, for the first 3 months of his life, maybe a little bit longer, totally blew that up. What I learned was that there's a time and a place to just kill your attachments, because not sleeping sucked enough, but then freaking out that I wasn't sleeping,
yeah,
that sucked even worse. So I think, like, again, this is something that is self-help writing makes you feel like, I got to do this or else I'm going to stink, and it can feel pretty rigid. Mm. But I think an overarching theme with all of this is again, back to what I said earlier, this self-awareness and knowing that there are different seasons and being okay with releasing from the agenda. Mm-hmm. With passion in particular, that's obviously top of mind for me right now, it's really hard to be self-aware in the midst of pursuing a passion because of that dopamine response that's just pushing you ahead. The word that I like to use is inertia. It feels like you're just being swept along in this inertia, or you're in a storm. And self-awareness is the ability to see outside of the storm. Because when you're in the storm, it's very hard to objectively evaluate trade-offs. But if you can create some distance between yourself and your passion, then you can look a little bit more broadly and say, like, do I really want to be sacrificing time with friends? Do I really want to be sacrificing time with family to do this?
So it's constantly reevaluating.
Yeah, and doing it in an honest way. There's some fascinating research that I cover in the book that shows that individuals that are in desire, are in passion, pursuing passions, the activity in their brain and the changes in their brain are very similar to someone that is suffering from an eating disorder. Someone that is suffering from an eating disorder, when they look in the mirror, they don't see somebody that is gaunt. They see somebody that is overweight. Somebody that is in the midst of a passion, when they look at their life, they don't see all the things that they're neglecting. They just see that they should be putting more time into their passion. So it's a practice to be able to step outside of that inertia and actually have the self-awareness to realize, whoa, like, I'm spending way too much time in this. Or even within a passion, to be able to evaluate, yikes, this passion's getting a little bit too obsessive. Because if you just leave that to its own devices, what will happen is your brain will take the path of least resistance, which is not having self-awareness, not making good trade-offs, and pursuing obsessive passion. So you have to kind of make a practice out of identifying these things, reflecting on them, course correcting when appropriate.
How do you handle what I might call external vulnerabilities? So, you know, you might have a coach of athletes that isn't that athletic, or somebody handing out nutritional advice that isn't that slender. You know, I think, do people look at you as like, oh, well, Brad is the guy that almost performs and he's just not fallible. You know, he's not going to fall foul of any of this stuff. Is that something that affects you at all?
It did for a period of time, but those people are just going to be disappointed. you know, I put on my pants every morning too. I'm a big believer in the things that I write about, but I don't write about them because I have them figured out. I write about them to figure them out.
Okay.
And I'm just as interested in figuring this stuff out for myself as I am for readers. So I'm along the same journey as my readers. Some areas of the things I write about, I'm farther along the path, and in other areas, I'm still a true beginner. I think that vulnerability is really important. I think that so many people, again, in this kind of self-help genre, they have all these hacks and they present themselves like they're Superman or Superwoman and they have it all together. To me, that's a sign that you should run the opposite direction from someone. Because if someone's not struggling with what they're working on, then A, they're probably not pushing themselves that hard. And B, they're probably lying to you because, like, we're humans, we struggle.
Yeah, I sometimes think that the best teacher is somebody that learned this 6 months ago, right? Like, I can relate to where you're at because I was doing the exact same thing 6 months ago. I think it's kind of a powerful concept.
Totally. And the humility to realize, at least in my case, that I'll probably be doing the same thing 6 months later. There's this beautiful quote from, it's an unattributed quote from an old Japanese Zen teacher that talks about practice. And she says that the way practice works is that we build our practice up and then it falls apart. And then we build it back up, and then it falls apart again. And that's just the way it goes. And I think that's true.
Yeah, you reminded me of the trans-theoretical model, the stages of change, right? It's like it's a cycle. Like, what the heck? Why is relapse in this thing? Like,
yeah.
Oh, well, that's what happens. It's a model of what happens.
And it gets back to what Alan Langer said, just about paying attention. I think that that's whether you're pursuing a passion, whether you are in a rut, whether you feel like you're on top of the world, I think just paying attention to how you're feeling and why you're feeling, that's a really good conduit to realizing what's good for you, what's not, and that things are impermanent. When you're in a rut, things are going to change. When you're on top of the world, that's going to change too.
Do you think this book could help somebody that is suffering from what you might call a midlife crisis? Could you define what you think a midlife crisis is and how the passion paradox might help that person suffering from one?
I hope so. It's funny. I was just talking about midlife crises with one of my best friends who's 38, who says that he's been in a midlife crisis for the last 6 years. and he said the new midlife crisis is like happens at 30. I don't know about that. But the way that I would define a midlife crisis is a reckoning with mortality and death and a questioning of who am I and what's the point of this all? What am I doing? Why am I spending my time what I'm doing? I think that people reach that point and it can be really discombobulating to both confront your mortality on the one hand, and on the other hand, confront the fact that maybe you're not spending your time how you want to be spending your time, or maybe you're not living in alignment with your core values. Maybe you haven't even reflected on what those core values are, and you don't know what you want to live in alignment with to begin with. Mm-hmm. I think that the book is helpful, The Passion Paradox is helpful for individuals that might be going through this, because A, it's a pretty self-compassionate book. Like, hopefully listeners can tell from this interview, I don't think I have it all figured out. Like, I've been there. I've been in that discombobulated place. Like I just said, I'll probably be there again. But when you're in that place, you can be kind to yourself, and there are so many different ways out of that place. And the book recommends a very incremental approach, as we discussed earlier, to finding a passion. Mm. Same thing to following a passion. It's funny, the subtitle of the book, the publisher was real keen to use the word go all in, but what the book actually says about cultivating a passion is that you want to do it very incrementally. Again, another kind of falsehood or myth in the self-help literature is that you should just quit your day job.
I was going to ask you about that.
No, that's not true. There's all this research that I cover in the book that shows that you have a much better chance of success in shifting gears to a passion if you pursue it incrementally and on the side. Mm. And I think that's really important for individuals in the midlife crisis. So if you identify, yikes, I'm going to die. I'm not necessarily doing what I want to be doing. Here's what I want to be doing. What self-help books are going to say is quit your job and do that. What the research shows, and what I recommend as a result of that research, is actually don't quit your job. Because if you quit your job, you might do that for 2 weeks and then fail at that because you have all this pressure on yourself. Mm. I would take baby steps in that direction. Let it start out as a hobby. Let it start out as a side gig. Maybe go from working 100% in your job to working 80% to working 70% and gradually pursue that thing until you get to a point where you have confidence based on evidence that if you do go all in, you're not going to set yourself up for failure. Mm-hmm. What happens when people go all in too prematurely is that they have this immense pressure, often to pay rent, to meet mm-hmm. their basic needs. So they start making sacrifices in the thing that they think that they love, and then they no longer love it. Mm-hmm. So this is the writer that gets their first story published and then quits their day job to write full time, and then suddenly is writing clickbait articles and listicles because they have to get a paycheck to pay for rent. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big believer in the research supports this and holding off on that temptation to just throw everything aside and go all in and actually pursue the thing gradually, be patient. Think of it, what would it look like to be all in 5 years from now?
That's interesting. You should bring that up. I've got a picture of me holding our daughter on the day that I came home from the hedge fund with the news that I'd quit my job to become a health coach. And my wife's sort of going, that's great news, honey. I'm right there with you. You know, but part of the reason I did that was I felt like I'd gotten to a point where I just couldn't move this thing any further unless I quit my job. And another thing is
But you said you got to a point. What
yeah, that's
that?
Right. That's right. So a lot of stuff happened on the side. And actually I got in trouble with that at work, you know, because I'd signed an agreement with the firm that every line of code that I wrote belonged to them. Mm. And I developed some custom software and a website in my spare time. And technically that belonged to them. You know, so it was a kind of a sticky situation where they weren't very happy about it.
Yeah. But I think it's important because you had been building the thing on the
side. Yeah, it didn't come out of nowhere, for sure.
And then you get to a point, though, where you do have to kind of go all in.
Right.
And that is great. And the key thing is, though, what do you do to get to that point? Mm-hmm. Like, if you would have just said, I can't do this anymore, I want to be a health coach, put in your 2 weeks' notice, and then start to figure out what it means to be a health coach, you can be successful taking that rash of a step, but the research shows that most people aren't. Most mm-hmm. people are successful kind of sneaking in the code on the side, getting a base, getting a starting point before they make the leap. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with hindsight, I would have been more careful about signing that contract, right?
Right.
I didn't even think about it at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get in trouble from people's employers, but I think that, you know, if you're finding that you're at your job and you feel like you're going through the motions, like, go ahead, start your side gig. Maybe don't do it on company computers, but again, this isn't just my opinion. There's research that was covered in The Economist recently that shows that like 40% of most white-collar work is just wasted time. So like fill that 40% with exploring a side hustle and see if that side hustle eventually becomes the thing that you do.
And was that successful for you? Because you were doing consulting for McKinsey.
Yeah.
And now you're a coach and a writer. You had a really interesting, the must and the should, which I thought was really nice.
Thanks.
And so have you been successful in incrementally changing over from the should to the must in your life?
Yeah, and it's been an 8-year journey. Even after McKinsey, I joined a healthcare system out here where I was doing consulting full time, and I very gradually went down from 100% to 90% to 80% in my quote-unquote day job as my writing and coaching picked up. And it was actually only a few months before this book came out that for the first time on paper, the majority of my income and the majority of my time was spent writing and coaching, not consulting. Mm-hmm. And I'll probably still always do a little bit of consulting work, partly because I like it, but also because having that thing that's always going to be there, it can feel really safe. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been like an 8-year journey to the point where now I can say I am a writer and I also coach, mm-hmm. not I'm a consultant. Mm-hmm. And I don't think if I would have just jumped in writing the first time I was published and got paid whatever it was, $150 for my first article, I don't think I would be here.
Yeah, interesting. And I don't think these things are static either, you know? So, you know, my version of that is at some point in time, I said, I really must help other people achieve what I've achieved with my health and performance, but I should write code. Like, I live in Silicon Valley. That's my safety net, right? If MBT ever doesn't work out, I can just go get another job as a coder. No big deal. And so I've continued to improve that skill and use it over time. So I'm not like super, you know, it's 5 years since I've written a line of code. Should the worst ever happen. But since then, I've kind of fallen in love with coding again. Like, I really enjoy doing that too, you know? And when it stopped being a, you know, I should do this, it becomes more appealing for some reason. I can't really figure that out.
I love how you said, like, I forgot the exact word you just used, but like, there's some seasonality to this. And being flexible, I think, is good. Like, there's nothing in the book or the research that says that you should just have one passion. Again, you might have a passion now that 5 years from now isn't, and you might have a different passion. Something else that comes out quite a bit in the book is passion is not, it's more of like a personality or a temperament than it is passion for one specific thing. So to me, cultivating passion is about cultivating energy and drive to pursue things that make you tick in a productive way. It's not about, I want to be the best power lifter. I want to be the best triathlete. I want to be the best coach. I want to be the best writer. Those are all just kind of objects that you point passion at. Mm. But once you have passion and you know how to use it, you can point it at all different kind of things at different parts of your life.
Mm-hmm. You said something in the book, which I loved, which was, don't try and be the best. Try and be the best at getting better.
Yeah, like, that's it.
Awesome. It's like a tiny tweak, but it's all the difference.
That is just so important, not to get too woo-woo here, but like to walk the path of mastery. Like, mastery does not know any end. Like, the end of mastery is when you die. So if you think that you're going to be the best, well, that's like an arrival point, but there is no arrival point. So like, just keep on growing, just keep on being the best at getting better and be willing to take interesting turns and follow those interests.
What advice would you give to somebody who is already at that burnout place?
First, I'd say it's hard. I'd say, don't judge yourself. Try not to get into the negative cycle of rumination where I can't believe I'm feeling this way. I've got all my needs met, yet I'm still feeling like crap. I'm a terrible person. Like, that self-judgment just makes things worse. I would say, and I think this is important to say, that if you're truly struggling to get out of bed in the morning, if you're having thoughts about self-harm, I would immediately get help from a therapist. I think that burnout and depression, anxiety, these are related syndromes. And, you know, self-help works, but sometimes you actually need other help beyond self-help. And then if you do feel like you're in a place where you're safe to work on coming out of this yourself, I would say give yourself time and space and realize that there are such strong habit energies that got you to where you are that you're not going to undo them overnight. And you're going to have the same urges. You might take a week off and feel great, but then you get back to work and it's all that same energy that's pushing you to work nonstop and be a sucker for external validation and be anxious about external validation. A vacation doesn't fix that. Like, it's a long journey to implement the practices that help hedge against that so that you can come out of it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about mentoring? I wanted you to talk about mentoring. So I'm doing that thing where I've read your book too well and I want, now I'm trying to lead you around like a little dog to say the things that I've heard you say in the book.
Yeah, mentoring.
Sorry, I apologize for that.
No. You're bringing up great points in the book. I appreciate it. Mentoring is wonderful and coaching is wonderful. That's one of the best ways to get your spark back for whatever it is that you're doing. When you work with someone else, you literally get beyond yourself. Mm-hmm. So like the ego part of you that cares, that's not the focus. The focus is on this other person. unless you're a real narcissist and like you only want to be a mentor so that that person then does
case
well,
we can't
so
help you
can say right. That's beyond my scope. You know, even if you are a real narcissist, my guess is that if you were to start mentoring someone, maybe at first you'd be like, I'm only going to do this because it'll elevate my status. Once you see that person coming into their own and succeeding, you'll probably forget about yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's an awesome feeling to forget about yourself. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's great about mentoring is you get to see the work in your pursuit through more virgin eyes. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to get disgruntled when you've been doing something for a long time. But when you get to watch someone just settle into it, they're going to probably settle into it in a way that has energy and that's slightly different than how you did. Mm-hmm. So it's so cliche to say this, but you learn just as much from the mentee as you're teaching them. I mean, coaching, teaching, there are all these things that help one get outside of their self. And I think all that stuff's really beneficial.
Well, this has been wonderful, Brad. Thank you. I think that's a really good place to wrap up. The name of the book we've been talking about is The Passion Paradox by Brad Stolberg, and your colleague whose name I've already forgotten. I'm sorry.
Steve Magnus.
Can you say a few words about Steve?
I'd love to. I'm glad it's coming up. So I wrote The Passion Paradox with Steve, and I also wrote my first book, Peak Performance, with Steve. Steve comes at these topics from a little bit more of an athletics lens. He is a coach to a handful of Olympic caliber long distance runners. And then he's also on staff at the University of Houston, where he coaches runners. He's an exercise scientist. Mm. I tend to spend more of my time in psychology, philosophy, even maybe spirituality. And the two of us realized that these two worlds that we're in are normally very siloed, but there's actually tons of overlap.
Yeah.
So we started working together. We've written these books together. We've become just collaborative partners.
Well, I very much appreciate it. After that interview with Ken Ford, I asked Simon if he could send me some papers to read on this whole finding your passion thing, which he did, about 12 of them. I think they might have been all review papers, and I don't think I got even halfway through the first abstract of one of them. I mean, like, I find his literature almost impenetrable in a way that I didn't find the other natural sciences, like biochemistry, for example, I found much easier to get into than any of the psychological stuff. So,
yeah, but what's interesting, and this could be a whole other conversation maybe for a later date, is a lot of these discrete fields are pointing towards like the same truths and the same patterns.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there was one last question just before I let you go that one of our clients asked, and I thought the same thing, and I realized I missed it. I should have asked you this much earlier on.
Yeah, go for it.
And that is, do you see a similarity between the fit mindset and the fixed mindset? So Carol Dweck described the fixed mindset.
Yeah.
And so this is the idea that some ostensibly trainable thing is actually fixed in time and space and can't be altered. And it's false. It's like, it's just not true. So the classic example that our neurologist friend Josh Turknet talks about is, I'm not a musical person. I couldn't possibly learn how to play the ukulele because I'm just not musical. And that's just false. Like, people
that belief is going to get in the way more than your genetics or whatever it is.
And so the fit mindset in my mind seems kind of similar because it's the idea that it's just like, I'm going to walk in there. It's going to be all sunshine and rainbows and she's going to be the one and I'll just know right away. And like, it's love will never change.
It's very similar. And it's most similar in the same way that the best intervention is just to know that that's a thing and to change your expectation. Mm-hmm. So Carol Dweck's work, the way out of a fixed mindset is to realize that actually there's this different way of looking at something, which is your ability is not fixed. And if you work at it, you might not become great, but you'll probably improve. Mm-hmm. And you'll improve at least enough to see if it's something that you want to pursue that you might become great at. Mm-hmm. And with passion, it's very much the same thing. Like, the intervention is just realizing that a fit mindset and setting an expectation so high is actually the foremost thing that's going to get in your way of finding what you really want.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I will, of course, link to your website online. You're a Twitter person, so people can engage with you on Twitter.
Yeah, now they can draw me into my obsessive rabbit hole. I am on Twitter. My username is @bstolberg.
Okay. And what about your coaching practice? Have you got any space in your coaching practice at the moment?
Yeah, I do. I have probably one or two openings. And in my coaching practice, I work predominantly with executives and entrepreneurs. And I help them kind of navigate their careers personally and professionally.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate you.
Thank you. This was a wonderful conversation.